I'm just going to adjust my thing here. So feel free to type in. It's wonderful. Audrey's here from France, and keep going. Keep letting us know. And of course, you can see that Sylvia is joining us today, and we're very blessed to have Sylvia here. And she will offer some teachings pretty soon. But just keep joining. Keep joining. Write in if you'd like where you're here from. And when you're ready, let's just move into our arriving meditation as usual. We begin with this arriving meditation. Then we'll talk with each other a little bit. Sylvia will offer some thoughts and say hello. And we'll have our longer meditation. And then I'll offer a Dharma talk, and we'll have plenty of time to talk with each other. So, as is usual, find a comfortable way to be in your body. Whether you're seated or standing, reclining, whatever you're doing, coming into the morning, sensing into the body just as it is. Eyes open or eyes closed, whatever works for you. If your eyes are open, just have a soft, gentle gaze downward. I like to begin by sensing into my body, sitting just as I am, with my feet on the floor and sensing the body touching the chair. And how I'm connected to the earth, supported from below, sensing down. And as you arrive, you may sense the breath. Just the coming and the going of the breathing. For the next few breaths, really notice it. Notice the inhale, and maybe even let the exhale be a little longer than usual as a way to settle, letting the inhale be an arriving, the exhale a settling. Do that for a few breaths to arrive. And as we settle in, coming into this time this morning, there may be some anticipation. Some excitement, noticing that in the body, noticing it in your heart and in your mind. Any good feelings of the mind and heart, see if you can invite that to flow in your body as a way to season, to flavor this moment. And as we settle into the body, into the mind and heart, we can set our practice time together with some intention. The intention to meet this moment just as we are. May I meet this moment fully. May I meet it as a friend. Really taking that in, the welcome of that intention practice. And we expand that beyond ourselves. Together, may we meet these moments fully. May we meet this time in our lives as friends. knowing that every time we come to practice, there's a welcoming in this. Practice is this good friend who is here. We sit down, we become present, we bring our whole selves, and we are welcomed into this time of settling the mind and tending the heart. Just being here. So welcome back, everybody. I didn't see you last week, and I missed being here, but I did listen to Kyra Jewel Lingo's talk. And so if you were here last week, I hope you enjoyed it. It was a very beautiful talk on intimacy and how we cultivate intimacy with ourselves, with one another, and with our communities in a larger scale. And the week before that, when I was here, we talked about the practices of renunciation and kindness and how they are two sides of the same coin, the symbiotic relationship of the two. And I think that this beautiful intention practice that Sylvia has given us, may I meet this moment fully, may I meet it as a friend, that is an expression and a manifestation of this intimacy, of this willingness to be just as we are and to come with this kind heart. It takes a quality of letting go, of simplification, of renunciation, to just be willing to show up. However we are, there's a letting go of the shoulds and the judgmental mind. May I meet this moment fully and to bring kindness, even when it's hard, we do it anyway. I remember years ago, I heard Sylvia, I heard you say, you know, I think we're just doing two things. I think we're doing two things with each other. We are companioning and we are consoling. And that really went in me. And I've been thinking about that and practicing with that ever since. I don't even remember when it was. We're companioning and consoling, and I think we are also celebrating. And I want to bring that into our practice as a regular piece of practice, that it points to our interconnection with one another, with all things. It points to this fundamental friendship, this quality of friendliness that is so important that we cultivate inside ourselves so it can touch others. And this is the Sangha. And this is how we meet Sangha fully and as friends. And I know that many of you know the story from the time of the Buddha, when his cousin Ananda approached the Buddha and sat down and said to him, "Venerable sir, half of this holy life is having good and noble friends, companionship, association with the good." And the Buddha said, "No, Ananda, no. Good and noble friends are the whole of the holy life." Believe that. Take that in. This is meeting the moment fully. This is meeting the moment as friends, as we companion and console and celebrate. That is the expression of this teaching from the Buddha. Good friends, this companionship, are the whole of the holy life. So this is our Sangha, who we come to meet with and be with every week, because this is what we do together. So with that, I want to welcome Sylvia back. I have tears in my eyes. I'm so happy to see you. I'm so happy that you are here. Welcome back. Let's unmute Sylvia if we can, Toland. There you go.
There I am. and I'm looking at all of you. And when Heidi said, how do you feel? Notice if you're excited. I was noticing how excited I was. First of all, I'm seeing so many of you that I know after such a long time, and I feel really excited about that. And maybe that's the whole thing. And I'm back teaching again, at least this morning, a little bit. It's this week, surprisingly. I knew sometime this would come, but I had an email from Heidi earlier this week, and she said, people are asking about you. How are you and what's happening with you? And should I tell them? And I said, no, I'll tell them. So this gives me a chance to come back and greet and re-greet people, a lot of people who I don't know and a lot of people who I do know. And I said, I'll come and I'll talk. And this is just yesterday. And I'll say something about what I'm thinking about these days. And so I'm really excited about being here. So I have not been here. I noticed on the Spirit Rock website, it says this class is the oldest established, along with Monday night, running class since Spirit Rock was before it even had a building. So we have been going for 25 and some years. And I've been away from it now for a year because my husband was sick. My husband was diagnosed with a terminal illness a year and a half ago. And for the last year, he's been getting sicker, and he died 3 weeks ago tomorrow. And I had the really good fortune of being able to take care of him here at home with the help of hospice. I'm really very fortunate to have a very large immediate family. He and I had four children who are all midlife adults now, with their own children, and in some cases, their own grandchildren. And they all live here. So it was really an incomparable and very fortunate situation for us to all be able to take care of Seymour here for this whole last year and to attend to him until he transitioned on to wherever people's spirit transitions to. And we took care of him. Hospice was an incredible help because they provide guidance, they provide all the medications, they provide all the stuff you need. And I had the extreme good fortune of having my family around to support us in that transition. And I decided about a year ago, after he'd been sick for a while, but was still actually physically quite all right, that I needed to stop coming on teaching on Wednesday mornings, because even though taking care of him was not a 24/7 hands-on job, it was a 24/7 hands-on think. And so I really had the feeling that I needed to have that space for myself so that I could pay full attention to what was happening here. And I knew that Heidi is wonderful, and I'm happy for her to be teaching now and established in the schedule. And as the year was going on, I also thought more and more about how much that year of seclusion with the situation in the world the way it is was for me, and probably for you in certain ways, with the pandemic, a kind of an extended retreat. I often had the image in my mind of the whole world, and I would think of the planet, and I think here's this whole planet, and it's struggling with climate change, and it's in many ways teetering on heating to the point of really being in a whole altered way of living. So the planet is sick. And within that large, and everybody in the planet is in that same sphere of what would I call it? Tentativeness. It's challenged. And then in the whole, within that whole planet being challenged, there's almost the entire planet challenged by the pandemic. And within that whole thing of everyone challenged with the same thing is the economic challenge that in many cases the pandemic is associated with, and in many cases the climate change is associated with. But there's the economic sphere of mutual struggle. So here's the planet struggling, the pandemic is struggling, economics are struggling, the political crisis in many places, and particularly in the United States, that's been happening for the last many years now, but intensely in the last year. And I keep thinking about all these layers of challenge. And then in our particular part of the United States, challenged by fires, challenged by droughts, challenged in big cities with epidemics and really overcrowding in hospitals. And then in each home, their own particular challenge. I thought about, we all share these huge challenges, and then individual challenges. So here I am in my home with Seymour is dying. So we are dealing with that particular thing. And across the road, my neighbor, who I pass in the driveway and we talk to, masked as we go to get our mail, my neighbor was diagnosed with an intestinal cancer, had his surgery, had post-surgery chemotherapy, and is now all well. So his crisis came and went. The neighbor on the other side got a new puppy, and they're all involved with the new puppy and taking care of the difficulties of a puppy, and we wave every day. And we had a new great-grandchild in the middle of that. So in the middle of Seymour's dying, we had a new great-grandchild, can you believe it, great-grandchild, get born, and spend a lot of my time on my phone looking at pictures of her. And I realized that somehow it was an amazing experience in the coming and going of personal dramas within bigger dramas, within bigger dramas, within bigger dramas. And in a sense, I come away after the whole year of it, and I think to myself, that's the whole thing. Everybody is having a drama and getting over it, and having a drama and coping, and then having a great, wonderful thing like a baby. Do you know when that baby was just born, and my grandson would send out bunches of pictures every day, and I'd be up in the middle of the night either doing something with Seymour or taking care of him or just getting up because I thought I heard him or because I wasn't sleeping very well. And I'd get up in the middle of the night and I'd want to go back to bed and sleep. So I would look at my, even though they say don't get on your phone in the middle of the night, it'll wake you up, I would get on my phone and look at pictures of the grandbaby in the middle of the night. And then I'd go back to bed. And I really felt, you know, whatever was happening, it was a tremendous boon to me to have a lesson right in front of me of the coming and goingness of life. Things come and things go, and everything has a lifetime. The extraordinary thing about my husband's life is that it lasted 89 years. So in no ways was it a calamity. I mean, he had a very full and a very wonderful life that he knew about and that he was very grateful for. When he said, when he was dying, he said, tell people not to be sad because I had a very good life. I did everything. I've had the same girlfriend for 70 years. I've had all these wonderful children who are in good shape. I have 7 grandchildren. I have 2 great-grandchildren. I have a full house. What do they call it in polka? It's called a royal flush. I have everything. I did everything I wanted. I have everything I need. I had a wonderful life. Take good care of yourself. I've heard that about other people as they were dying. And I thought that's wonderful. I hope I say that. And as he was dying, what he was mostly saying to me was take good care of yourself. I think it'd be a marvelous thing if we just said to each other all the time, take good care of yourself. It would be the evidence of the good heart that Heidi was just talking about, cultivating a heart that's friendly to each moment of our life as it arises, and each person and each relationship as it comes into view. Take good care of yourself. Be well. So one of the things that I thought about is that I began to think now, since he's gone, in however way I understand gone, doesn't feel so gone, by the way. I mean, the daily caring for him is gone. But there are other ways, which I'm just learning about, which I'll tell you someday, in which he's not so gone. Somebody who's been a part of your life for a long time doesn't disappear out of your life. I can't remember who it is who said, death ends a life, but not a relationship. And it seems to me that that is definitely true. It's not that people keep saying, have you had any messages from him? And I'm waiting to have some cosmic voice speak out, or a book fall out of the bookcase, or some really extraordinary paranormal event happen. But that's not happening. What's happening is I am discovering how I think I am changed by this whole long retreat. If the point of our practice is to develop equanimity with the changing events of our lives as they arise and pass away, I think that it's been good for me about that. I was thinking about when I was a child and we came back to school in September after having been away for 2 or 3 months for the summer vacation. We most often had the first homework assignment was write an essay called What I Did on My Summer Vacation. Did you do that? Raise your hand if you did that. Everybody did that because everybody was gone and now everybody's back. And then I thought, what's been on my mind is what did I learn on this long retreat that I've been on? I'm happy to tell you, by the way, that I am up for my second COVID vaccination a week from today at this very time. So I am thrilled about that. Not going to be able to do anything much different from now, but that means more people are finished being vaccinated. My most exciting trip that I can think about taking is I'll get to go to the supermarket masked and all that. But people have been shopping for me for this whole year because I'm old and so I stay out of the supermarkets. I think it'd be so exciting to go into the supermarket full of stuff. I'm thrilled about that. And then soon enough, everybody will get vaccinated and we'll be able to visit and hug each other. It turns out most people have had the same response that they when talk about what do you most want to do when the pandemic is over, they say, I want to really hug somebody. So we'll hug pretty soon. But I was thinking about what did I learn from my summer vacation, from my year-long intense retreat. Well, I learned a couple of things that I can say the outlines of. And then I'm hopeful that maybe next month I'll come back and teach a whole class. One of the things that I learned is that whatever fundamental truths that I knew that from my life before or from my retreat practice before, or from hearing about Dharma and teaching it before, I don't know any different truths than I used to know, but I know some of them better. And, you know, it's always been, some of you have heard me say sometimes in teaching, I not infrequently have the experience of saying something as I'm teaching and then saying, oh, I said that so well. And I just now got it in a way that was more profound than I ever got it before. Do you hear me ever say that? Because I say, I knew this. I've known this a long time. But now I really know it. And I said, now I really know it. And then later on, it's the same truth again. Things get worse when we add struggle to a challenge in life. We can change our minds so that we don't struggle so much and be more liberated from suffering. The same truths. But all of a sudden, I know them better. The same truth, not new truth, different truth. And that's so pleasant to me to think about that the fundamental instruction in practice is pay attention. Not pay attention to breath, although we sometimes do, or pay attention to the state of mind or the heart, all of the above. Pay attention to the body, all of the above. But the abbreviated instruction is pay attention all the time. What's happening and what response is the response that chooses peace rather than suffering? And how can I make that determination? And how can I do it more frequently so that it becomes a habit? I love what Heidi said about companioning, consoling, and celebrating. Because first of all, I always love things that are like sweet to think about, like three C's. What do you see? I see companioning, consoling, and celebrating. That's all the better. It could be three different letters, but hey, it's better this way. So I like that very much. But I like the idea that as we get older, it's less complicated. Yesterday, this is what I'll end with, and then we'll sit some. So when I come back in a month or whatever, the teaching that I have in my mind is how do I understand some of the things that I always knew in a new way. I didn't even know in a better way, in a new way. How does that make me feel? How is my life different? So yesterday in some email exchange with some friends of mine, a friend of mine who lives in Washington, D.C., had some very, very complicated surgery. It was coming up for a long time. And a number of her friends who are in week, we're all in a group of friends who are in weekly Zoom contact with each other. And one of us has needed to have this surgery. And so yesterday was the day. And the numbers of emails on the joint flying back and forth emails that originated in Washington with a friend who lives there, who took her to the hospital and was there afterwards, going back and forth and back and forth, and how is she and how long is she in there? And we kept each other company by our mutual shared concern and comfort and prayers, and everybody making incantations and may this and may that. And in fact, the surgery was very successful. It looks like it's going to be a success. Looks like she's going to get better. And so today, all the emails are celebratory, which are really touching, because they all manifest that. They all really translate as caring about other people. That's what they all mean. That's another C, isn't it? Caring through companioning, consoling, and celebrating. And I recalled as that was going on, we had spent the whole day not deeply meditating in a quiet place, but consoling each other and praying for Betty and back and forth and telling each other. And I remembered that many years ago, I was sitting with my friend Sharon Salzberg, who was my original loving kindness teacher. And I said, Sharon, what do you think we're going to do when we're, what are we going to be doing when we're old? And she said, I don't know, Sylvia, probably we'll be sitting around. She said, probably we'll be sitting around praying for people. And I remember that's exactly what she said. And I like that very much, especially because of the use of the word around. We'll be sitting around praying for people. So it wasn't like diligent. It wasn't like uncomfortable. It seemed like a casual thing to do, to just sit around praying for people. We didn't have to be in a special position or beseeching. And I thought yesterday, particularly, of who are all these people thinking about Betty and hoping so much, we're all the while having the experience of I'm not alone, because we're all talking to each other. We're supporting each other with companioning. We're supporting ourselves with the experience of caring about somebody a great deal. And the biggest beneficiary of loving kindness is always our own hearts. I'm so convinced of that. And I didn't even realize it actually till one sentence ago, as I was just now saying it to you, that that it's so pleasant to be discovering, to feel so completely connected to somebody else's well-being. And somehow I thought about that phrase of Sharon, we'll be sitting around praying for people. And I thought to myself, probably that means if I'm successful in my practice, it won't be just my practice sitting and my practice in learning to organize or see through or figure out my thoughts. It'll be my practice of having my default position of my mind be that of habitual benevolence. What if my mind, through wisdom, the wisdom that everyone is challenged all the time, the whole planet is challenged in all those levels of challenge, all the way down to my house and my neighbor's house and my another neighbor's house and another neighbor's house. Everybody is challenged. To the degree that I can see that, to that degree does it tone down my irritable rhetoric and turn up my benevolent capacity, which is, I think, what I really would think about as being my my hope, my aspiration in my practice. I love being back and talking to you. So thank you very much for letting me come. And one of the things that I love is I've been looking at one page of you so I can see 25 people, because but all the while I want to see who's on the other pages. So now when Heidi leads this meditation, I am going to make sure to look at all of my pages and be looking at all of you and feeling that as I do it. And I look forward to seeing you all whenever we see each other soon. Oh, when you look through this, you will see Emily Boorstein Wickman, who I now see is on this call. So one of my adult daughters is now on this call. So it's a pleasure. I'll be delighted whenever we meet again. And please take good care of yourself.
Thank you, Sylvia. I think we've been sitting around praying for a long time. This is what we're doing together. We come and we talk with each other and we sit quietly inside ourselves, but with each other. And this is what we do. We're sitting around and praying. What a beautiful way to put it. And learning what we know more deeply and more deeply, the size of that K, right, from the lowercase K, gets to be really big, because we start to really understand who we are and who each other is, and that really, when it comes down to it, there isn't much else to do except to companion and console, to celebrate, to care, on and on. That's what we're doing. We're showing up for each other. Our practice really is for the benefit of one another. And when we're lucky, it benefits us too. It is a continuous circle. Maybe it's a Mobius. So with that, let's move into our meditation. So once again, please, finding a posture that really suits you, whether it's seated, standing, reclining, maybe you're even doing walking meditation. I really want to invite that too. Sometimes the body needs to move. So feel free to move into a walking meditation also. So once again, settling into the body. Just be in the posture you are in and know it. There's nothing else to do. Sensing the stability of the body just as it is. How the spine grows out of the deep low back to the crown of the head. In whatever posture you're in, that's how it works. And there's an uprightness, a wakefulness that comes when we can sense into the growth of the spine to the crown. And holding just enough energy in the back body to stay attentive and awake. And then inviting the entire front of the body from the forehead down through the face, the jaw and tongue, throat, chest and belly, whole front of the body to soften so there's room for the breath, there's room for the heart. The sense of a stable, strong back and a soft, receptive front. And relaxing. Meeting this moment fully, meeting it as a friend. Sensing into the very palpable care that is in this room with us, this Zoom room, it's here. Finding whatever suits you, whether it's the breath or the body, or perhaps your metta practice, find that place where you can let your awareness and your attention settle. To where it can stay. And of course, the mind will drift off. It'll start making grocery lists or whatever it does. And when you notice it, welcome it back. Begin again, over and over again. Being here, with this inward listening, the returning, trusting this practice of awareness. And maybe even sensing the quality of appreciation or gratitude just for being here today. And we'll sit quiet. as the mind settles, you might notice that there is a quality of stillness or ease, calm that is emerging. Let your awareness take that in. Sense into any amount of this emerging stillness. Settle there. And drawing the awareness now into the heart center. And sensing as you can any of the energy of the heart, the area of the center of the chest, the upper back. And sensing this heart energy above and below, back in front of the heart, sides and even diagonals. And if you like, moving into this practice of the heart's breath, imagine drawing fresh energy and breath into the heart center with the inhale. May I meet this moment fully. And as you breathe back out into every direction, may I meet it as a friend. The heart softens, becomes a little more spacious, stable, bigger. This is the heart's breath. You may try that for a couple of rounds. And as we move into our practice of metta, of loving kindness, we'll do a practice of radiating metta today. As the heart opens and warms with this heart's breath, imagine surrounding yourself with the radiance of your own heart, the warmth of your own good heart, the ways in which we companion and console and celebrate ourselves. We train in that direction. Surrounding yourself with your own love, your own deep caring. Sense that any amount. And then bringing to mind anybody in your world who comes to mind, and let your heart beam that same kind of warm energy, that caring energy, to this being's heart, radiating the metta. And maybe it's with phrases. May you be safe and well and at ease. Radiating the intention. Of well-being. And sense in your own body and heart and mind what that's like to let the radiance of your caring beam out. And we're going to share these blessings now out loud. It may be a cacophony of sound, but we're all going to be unmuted in another moment, all at the same time. And this is our practice that we share of saying out loud, right here. It might be crazy. Maybe we'll just do part, we'll see how this goes. So I will begin, and then what you can do is just unmute yourself. Hopefully this is going to work. I'm actually thinking of all of us this morning in our great good fortune to be here together to share these practices and the warmth that I sense from being part of this loving community. Who are you thinking of? Go ahead and just unmute.
Well, I am also thinking that, I think we have to unmute Heidi, just one of us at a time is going to work, I think. I'm really feeling quite filled up with pleasure and comfort of looking at all of you, those people that I know and those people that I don't know, and feeling like time doesn't make any difference. It's been a year since I've seen most of you, and it feels like yesterday. And I feel good for all of you to be part of an ongoing, welcoming community. I really think more and more, as our world is speeded all up and the challenges of the world are so big and manifold and thick and fast, to have a prayer community that sits together quietly once a week at least is a great piece of good fortune for me, and I think for all of us, so I'm glad for it.
Anybody else would like to speak into the room? We have another minute.
For my friend, Cindy, a wonderful, active, vibrant, exuberant 89-year-old woman who died of complications of a stroke last week. May she rest in peace.
Thank you.
I'm sending loving kindness to my son-in-law. He's really a good person, a good husband, good dad, But we have our challenges, and it's been really helpful to send him metta. Thank you.
Anybody else?
I'm sending metta to my daughter-in-law, who also I have a very interesting relationship with, but I am just sending her so much love.
Thank you.
I'm thinking about my brother and his family who are going through a hard time right now, and hoping they find a way through. I know they will. And also my neighbor, Amy, who was just diagnosed with cancer. May she be well. Thank you.
So we'll end this meditation with a deep bow of gratitude to all of us for showing up, for the pleasure of getting to be in the room with Sylvia and welcome Sylvia back from such a big year, and to share the experience with us so we can companion and console and celebrate. I'm so glad you were here, Sylvia. We'll see you next time you're here. It won't be long. Okay, everybody, we will take a 5-minute break and then come back and talk with each other. All right. Offer this together. So it's really a wonderful treat. I want to begin with a poem that I think encapsulates, it encapsulates so much of what we talk about. This is called Small Kindnesses from Danusha Lamaris. I've been thinking about the way when you walk down a crowded aisle, people pull in their legs to let you by. Or how strangers still say bless you when someone sneezes, a leftover from the bubonic plague. Don't die, we're saying. And sometimes when you spill lemons from your grocery bag, someone else will help you pick them up. Mostly we don't want to harm each other. We want to be handed our cup of coffee hot and to say thank you to the person handing it, to smile at them and for them to smile back. For the waitress to call us honey when she sets down the bowl of clam chowder, and for the driver in the red pickup truck to let us pass. We have so little of each other now, so far from tribe and fire, only these brief moments of exchange. What if they are the true dwelling of the holy, these fleeting temples we make together when we say, here, have my seat. Go ahead, you first. I like your hat. That's what we're doing, isn't it? Can we notice these small acts that fill us, that mean that they say to us, I see you. I know you're here. These are small things. That's why it's called small kindnesses. But can we train enough in our practices of awareness, even our ethical practices, our practices of love, to be able to show up in that way, where we really do pay attention to one another? So I want to talk today, bringing in so much of everything that we've been talking about in recent weeks, from about, I don't know if it was a month ago or the beginning of February, when we talked about joy. Joy as contentment. Joy as sort of a foundational place out of which we can live, joy even as an act of resistance. And then 2 weeks ago, talking about practices of renunciation, and then we had the lovely exchange around the poem Kindness and listening to Emma Thompson recite it and seeing how these two practices work so well together. And then last week with Kyra Jewell, talking about the necessity of intimacy, of growing enough capacity within ourselves that we really can get to know ourselves deeply, however we are, and that so much of our practice is turning towards, right? It is learning to notice the ways that we push away aspects of ourselves or each other, but to actually include all of that. So I want to talk a little bit about how do we do all of this? I'm finding that this is now become a very regular place in my practice where as I study and I read teachings and I listen to many teachers teach and offer perspectives, there are so many teachings that sound really good, right? They sound really good. And you go, yeah, I want that. I want that. But I want to dig in a little bit deeper so it's not just this thing of, oh yeah, if I read that teaching, it'll change me. I want to know how to do it. This is, I think, where our practice really comes alive. How do I train myself to stop pushing things away or pulling in so tightly? How do I understand when envy and jealousy get inside of me? How do I train in unhooking from those places? So I want to share with you a piece that we'll put up on the screen in a moment. This is called The Monk's Manifesto. And this comes from a woman named Christine Valtners Paintner. She's the abbess of an online abbey in Ireland called the Abbey of the Arts, which is a monastery without walls. It's an online monastery that offers classes and resources that nurtures the contemplative creative life. So I'm going to read this to you and then we'll take it apart. Okay, so you can see it. So you can see it as we read it. So this comes back, before we start reading it, I want to just remind us all that last month when I said, what are some of the things you want to talk about? One of the things that came up was discipline and practice. And I think that discipline it's a very important part of practice, right? Because it creates a habit of practice and it prioritizes our cultivation of this awareness. So I think that cultivating discipline and practice, this dedication, is vital. And here's a way to do it. So I want to read this to you. You can read along with me. Here's the first one. I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude to make space for another's voice to be heard and to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both without and within. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. I commit to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom I can share my deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. I commit to cultivating awareness of my kinship with creation and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy and things and letting go of what does not help nature to flourish. I commit to bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts in the world in meaningful ways. I commit to rhythms of rest and renewal through the regular practice of Sabbath and resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. I commit to a lifetime of ongoing transformation, recognizing that I'm always on a journey with both gifts and limitations. So I realize I forgot to bring something. I'm just going to exit for a second. Okay. So I find this to be really beautiful. Let's take it down, Tolan, because I can only see about five people when we have it up, if that's okay. And then I'll read them to you, and Tolan will put it in the chat. This is widely available online, The Monk's Manifesto. That's all you need to know. So you can get it that way. And I've taken some editorial liberties with it. I've changed some of the language just slightly. So if you look it up, you'll see that it's pretty close, but it's just a little bit different. So I want to take these apart one by one and talk about how they relate to our practice and how it becomes, these commitments become part of a discipline and really work to take us into how do we do these? How do we integrate and make real these teachings that are so beautiful and so timeless? So the first one, I commit to finding moments each day for silence and solitude to make space for another voice to be heard, to resist a culture of noise and constant stimulation. So that's a big deal, right? How do we actually commit to solitude, to finding moments? It doesn't say to spend hours each day in silence and solitude. It says to notice the moments. And how I relate to this is that this is where I can integrate the refuges for myself, to commit to moments of silence and solitude that make space not only for the voices inside me that I know, but the other voices outside of me or other places inside of me that I'm getting to know. We have places in us that we know well, places that we don't know, and that leaves space for me to remind myself why I'm doing this practice. So you can do whatever you want as far as what are these ways that you find that remind you why you're doing what you're doing, why you show up over and over again, how we companion ourselves. And the refuges for me, reclaiming or committing to the refuge of the Buddha, this capacity to awaken, relying on, I think of a refuge as a reliable, safe place to go where I can be me. And I feel that when I take refuge in the Buddha, in my own internal Buddha nature, the capacity that I can keep learning and awakening many moments, many times. And the refuge of the Dharma, the way things are, the nature of things, in addition to what the Buddha taught, which is also the Dharma. But the Dharma means the truth or the nature of things, how things are. And when I make space for a little silence, for a little solitude, I'm reminded of the way things are. And refuge in the Sangha. I think we can't take that more seriously enough. That how important it is that we keep showing up together over and over again. In fact, you may know that Thich Nhat Hanh says that the next Buddha is the Sangha. That's how important we are for one another. The next Buddha is the Sangha. And that Sylvia could be gone for nearly a year, taking care of her husband and her family, and come right back in and pick up where she left off. Right? Isn't that what Sangha does? That's it. That is what it does. Rilke says, I hold this to be the highest task of a bond between two people, that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other. We care for each other's practices and commitments. I hold this to be the highest task of a bond between two people, that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other. So in this way, we can look at refuge as make my heart a refuge for all beings. Can we take that on as a practice and we work with that in our quiet moments? The second one, I commit to radical acts of hospitality by welcoming the stranger both within and without. I recognize that when I make space inside my heart for the unclaimed parts of myself, I cultivate compassion and the ability to accept those places in others. So this is obviously an extremely important practice, that when we can make space for others, when we stop rejecting and doing the othering, that our hearts get bigger. There's more space for ourselves, and it supports our well-being, because then the judgmental mind quiets down. When we notice the normal, the natural, ignoble thoughts that come in our minds, we all have them. We don't have to beat ourselves up about it. We just know, oh yeah, look at that. Look at that thought. And we start to really learn cultivating compassion. This is why we need our metta practice. We need to understand what compassion is, that we really know that difficulty can befall and does any one of us at any time. You know, Sylvia tells a story about somebody a long time ago, a friend of hers who had cancer at a young age, and they were having a conversation about how does this happen, you know, that a 35-year-old can have a terminal illness and somebody else lives to 90, smoking cigarettes their whole life. How does this happen? And the conversation was, you know, we can say, well, why me? Why me? Or we can say, why not me? This is this ability to have a bigger view. Everything happens to everybody, and this is how compassion really does grow. Rachel Naomi Raymond, this is what she says about compassion, and I think this is one of my favorite ways to relate to what compassion is. Compassion begins with the acceptance of what is most human in ourselves, what is most capable of suffering. In attending to our own capacity to suffer, we can uncover a simple and profound connection between our own vulnerability and the vulnerability of others. Experiencing this allows us to find an instinctive kindness towards life, which is the foundation of all compassion. To commit to radical acts of hospitality that welcome ourselves and others, all aspects of ourselves, and we train in not othering others, not pushing others out of our hearts. Again, making my heart a refuge for all beings. The third one, I commit to cultivating community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom I can share my deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. Again, this is our Sangha. This is what we do for each other. When we say to a trusted friend, what do you think? What do you think? What am I not seeing here? I need a little help, right? When we welcome others into these intimate places in ourselves, or when we start recognizing, you know, that as more and more people are getting vaccinated, and that what Sylvia said, oh, we just want to hug each other. I just want to go to the grocery store and see another person. And to recognize what's happened for so many of us in the last year, the disconnect, and how much we do need to see each other. Here is a poem from Laura Grace Weldon. It's called You Don't Know Me, But. I miss you, fellow walkers, dad with double stroller, rainbow legging woman, earnest black hound hauling graybeard man on a never slack leash. I miss the Mark's checkout clerk with three nose rings, bitten nails, sardonic asides. Miss the librarian whose voice is soft as my mother's was back when I sobbed myself weak, her hand stroking my hair while she looked out the window. Wherever you are now, I wish you well. Cast light around you each night before you sleep. I want your granny to pull through, your job to stick around, your landlord to grant you every dispensation. I want flowers to sprout in your garbage, old milk to turn into yogurt. May your junk mail transform into loans forgiven, scholarships granted, grievances forgotten. May we see each other soon, smile in recognition, reimagine a world where we all breathe free. Committing to cultivating a community by finding kindred spirits along the path, soul friends with whom we can share our deepest longings, and mentors who can offer guidance and wisdom for the journey. I think it's coming, right? I think things are going to open up. Hopefully they're going to open up, and that as we see each other, that we remember how dear we are to each other. That we really remember that. And we don't take each other for granted. The fourth one. I commit to cultivating awareness of my kinship with creation and a healthy asceticism by discerning my use of energy and things, letting go of what does not help nature to flourish. So I think this is about reciprocity and renunciation, protecting what we love and letting ourselves be loved in return. So last week when Kyra Jewell was talking about not only do we cultivate intimacy with ourselves, each other, a wider community, but the earth, to understand how deeply interconnected we are and dependent on a healthy earth. So I want to read you a piece out of Braiding Sweetgrass from Robin Wall Kimmerer. You may know, some of you may know this book. It's a very beautiful book. Robin Wall Kimmerer is a Native American botanist. And a segment that I want to read to you comes from a chapter called Epiphany in the Beans, like the string beans in the garden. How do I show my girls I love them on a morning in June? I pick them wild strawberries. On a February afternoon, we build snowmen and then sit by the fire. In March, we make maple syrup. We pick violets in May and go swimming in July. On an August night, we lay out blankets and watch meteor showers. In November, that great teacher, the woodpile, comes into our lives. That's just the beginning. How do we show our children our love, each in our own way, by a shower of gifts and a heavy rain of losses? Maybe it was the smell of ripe tomatoes or the orioles singing or that certain slant of light on a yellow afternoon and the beans hanging thick around me. It just came to me in a wish of happiness that made me laugh out loud, startling the chickadees who were picking at the sunflowers, raining black and white hulls on the ground. I knew with a certainty as warm and clear as the September sunshine, the land loves us back. She loves us with beans and tomatoes, with roasting ears and blackberries and bird songs. By a shower of gifts and a heavy rain of lessons, she provides for us and teaches us to provide for ourselves. That's what good mothers do. I look around at the garden and could feel her delight in giving us these beautiful raspberries, squash, basil, potatoes, asparagus, lettuce, kale, and beets, broccoli and peppers, Brussels sprouts, carrots, dill, onions, leeks, and spinach. It reminded me of my little girl's answer to, "How much do I love you?" "This much," they said with arms stretched wide. This is really why I made my daughters learn to garden, so they would always have a mother to love them long after I'm gone. The epiphany in the beans. I spend a lot of time thinking about our relationships with land, how we are given so much and what we might give back. I try to work through the equations of reciprocity and responsibility, the whys and wherefores of building sustainable relationships with ecosystems, all in my head. But suddenly, there was no intellectualizing, no rationalizing, just pure sensation of baskets full of mother love. The ultimate reciprocity, loving and being loved in return. It came while picking beans, the secret of happiness. Knowing that you love the earth changes you, activates you to defend and protect and celebrate. But when you feel that the earth loves you in return, That feeling transforms the relationship from a one-way street to a sacred bond. Commit to cultivating the awareness of my kinship with creation. That this land, this earth, it is not to be taken for granted. And isn't it an amazing thing to think, does the earth love us back? What a concept. What a concept. The fifth one. I commit to bringing myself fully present to the work I do, whether paid or unpaid, holding a heart of gratitude for the ability to express my gifts in the world in meaningful ways. I think this is about generosity and faith, faith being a trust and a confidence that what we do not only matters, it is important and not to be diminished. How often do we say to ourselves, it doesn't really matter if I do that or not, even when we have the inclination to participate, to volunteer, to show up, and we might think, oh, they won't miss me if I'm not there. Ever have that feeling? Oh, they won't miss me if I'm not there. You want to bet? I mean, let's actually think about how many times maybe we've been in a group, or do you come to this group and we look around and say, oh, where's so-and-so? Because their presence is important. So not to doubt that when you bring yourself fully, it's meaningful. What you do is meaningful. It is valuable. It's surely valuable to others. Maybe not all others, but some others. We don't know the ripples of our work, but there are. You can count on that. And that's karma, right? That's the interconnection. This piece of that karma means action, that every action has a consequence. Andrew Olensky, who is a Buddhist scholar and a translator of the Pali, what he says is, every mindful moment in which generosity displaces greed, compassion takes the place of hatred, and insight dislodges delusion, is a moment in which we are awake. So this discipline of practice is helping us see clearly and uproot greed, ill will, and delusion. And so committing to bringing myself fully to whatever I do is a gift. It's an act of generosity. And that's why he says, every mindful moment in which generosity displaces greed, compassion takes the place of hatred, and insight, wisdom, dislodges delusion, is a moment in which we are awake. So we don't have to wait for the big bang. Right? Are we going to have the big bang of enlightenment or awakening? I don't know about that. What I think is it's many moments, many times. Every time we have the wisdom towards generosity, when we notice ill will in ourselves and we do what we can to let that go, and we allow our innate wisdom to guide us, that's a moment of awakening. And every time we do it, it reinforces it and it builds on itself. The sixth one, I commit to rhythms of rest and renewal through the regular practice of Sabbath and resist a culture of busyness that measures my worth by what I do. Oh my God, I can't tell you how often, for a very long time, I was in small business, and I guess I sort of still am, but in my work of being in business, I started to base my worth on production, right? Like, how much could I get done in a day? Or in my business that was the laundromat for 20 years, what were the sales? How many customers came through the door? And it didn't take me very long to know that while, yes, of course, that was important because there's a budget and there are expenses and it's critical, when the work itself is done well with wholesome motivation, financial parts, the production parts fall into place very often. It's not about production. It's not about sales when the fundamental components are rooted in ethics and goodness. And I'm not saying it's magic. I'm saying that we tend to value ourselves based on our production. And can we shift that to understanding that taking care of ourselves deeply is intricately connected with what we are able to do in our lives? So that this culture that values busyness as an outward expression is actually not where it's at. That we need these times of quiet. We need to come together on these Wednesday mornings. And there's a trust that happens from that. And it's very wise when we listen to, oh yeah, I need to go sit. I need to take a week off or 2 days off. Or for some of us, a half a day would be a long time to just back off. Depending on our work, depending on our age, depending on where we are in our lives. Here's this beautiful piece from Thoreau, from Walden. Sometimes in a summer morning, having taken my accustomed bath, I sat in a sunny doorway from sunrise till noon, wrapped in a reverie amidst the pines and hickories and sumacs, in undisturbed solitude and stillness, while the birds sing around or flitted noiseless through the house, until by the sun falling in at my west window, or the noise of some traveler's wagon on a distant highway, I was reminded of the lapse of time. I grew in those seasons like corn in the night, and they were far better than any work of the hands would have been. They were not time subtracted from my life, but so much over and above my usual allowance. To really know how deeply we are nourished by refuge and renewal, by rest and rejuvenation. And that to take time for contemplative practice, to have a dedicated, disciplined time for meditation is actually supporting everything else in your life. If you come to it with that motivation, it's not an escape, but actually it is deeply nourishing us so we can be fully present. And the last one, I commit to a lifetime of ongoing transformation, recognizing that I'm always on a journey with both gifts and limitations. Right? We just keep coming back over and over again, and we're not always going to get it right, and we're going to correct, we'll course correct, we'll come back. But it's not about where we're getting. There is no there. It's about what we're doing every minute of every day. Robin Wall Kimmerer, who also the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, she says, transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. Transformation is not accomplished by tentative waiting at the edge. You got to engage with your life, right? If you just sit on the outskirts, it's not going to happen. So we commit to a lifetime of being engaged, of ongoing transformation, knowing that sometimes we get it and sometimes we don't. But when you get, I'm learning to play the banjo, and it's really a lot of fun. And I was saying to a banjo teacher the other day, I got 30 seconds of flow. It felt so great. It was just 30 seconds. And she said, you know, when we get 30 seconds of flow in anything, it's really great. And it's true. We have to keep coming back over and over again. So when you get a piece of your meditation practice where all of a sudden nothing is happening and you're just there, and then you go, oh my God, nothing's happening. I'm just there. And then it goes away. Right? Because it's just how this works. But we just keep coming back over and over again. This is the journey. And sometimes it flows and sometimes it's hard. And we're just willing to do it because the transformation takes engagement.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.